Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Legal gambling in 2020 generated more than $643 million for the state of Ohio. Some of that revenue is devoted to the ravages of problem gambling. In January 2012, a total of 134 Ohioans reached out to the state's problem gambling helpline. That's three times as many called the hotline just this past January. The state-run Ohio for Responsible Gambling Organization estimates that more than 90,000 residents of Columbus alone struggle with gambling. At the individual level, gamblers lose money. Many hide the problem, rack up huge debt, and sometimes turn to crime to support the addiction. We're talking about the causes and costs of gambling addiction. Stacy Fronapple-Hassan is Chief of Prevention and Problem Gambling Services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Welcome to the show. Hello, Stacy Fronapple-Hassan. Welcome. Okay, we're going to work on that connection problem. Maria Garner is a licensed social worker and problem gambling counselor at Mary Haven, a Central Ohio Comprehensive Behavioral Health Services provider specializing in addiction recovery. Welcome to the show, Maria.
Thank you. Good morning.
How do we define, there's lots of euphemisms, I guess, for lack of a better word, about a gambling addiction or a gambling problem. How do we define it?
Okay, gambling problems or gambling disorder is an uncontrollable urge to gamble despite the tolls that it takes on your life. So you will gamble even when you can't pay your rent. So those are some things that happen with gambling disorder. Also, gambling disorder itself or just gambling is when you risk something of value in the hope of getting something of equal or greater value in return. So if I were going to look at somebody and find out or kind of look at, to gauge whether or not someone had a gambling problem, I would look at whether or not they were preoccupied with gambling and how that plays out in their life. Are they thinking about gambling all the time? Are they thinking about getting money to gamble? Are they thinking about when they're going to get to go gamble? Is it the thing that preoccupies their mind? So I hope I answered.
Yeah. And another thing about this whole thing, we usually think of an addiction as something that you ingest somehow, whether you smoke it or you eat it or you drink it, right? Gambling, it's not like you're putting anything in your body. What's that about, Maria Garner?
Well, that's because there's chemicals in your brain. And those chemicals in your brain, they are released. And when they are released, it gets to a point to where a person with a gambling disorder will have no breaks. In other words, it kind of overrides the brain. And that person has no way of stopping. So think of it in terms of the chemical in your brain is the chemical or the chemicals in your brain, the neurotransmitters, those are the things that are creating the problem with the addiction, and not so much ingesting a substance.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about problem gambling today. That's Maria Garner. She is a licensed social worker and problem gambling counselor at Mary Haven in Central Ohio. If you have a question or comment about gambling today and the problems it can cause, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Also with us, Stacy Fronapple-Hassan. She is Chief of Prevention and Problem Gambling Services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Stacy Fronapple-Hassan, have we come to understand gambling and its impact on the brain better in recent years?
Hi, Ann. Sure, we can talk about that. And that is We understand gambling the same way we would look at a cocaine addiction, for example, or methamphetamine. Mm-hmm. It is lighting up parts of the brain that an actual drug will light up. So in order to help someone with that addiction, that treatment looks very similar to other alcohol drug addiction treatment. There's about 20% that is very unique to the problem gambler or the person with gambling disorder. And someone like Maria knows how to dive into that 20% because, as she said, it has to do with chemicals in the brain, but it also has to do with genetics. It also has the habits we get into, whether or not something triggers us. I mean, for me, that might be a brownie. You know, I see chocolate and I'm thinking brownie, chocolate, baked goods. And that's what
yeah, I think I'm familiar with that one too.
So, yes. It's different for different people, but for gambling, it's extremely dangerous.
It's the psychiatric community has regarded compulsive gambling, uncontrollable gambling, as more of a compulsion than an addiction. How does that change treatment, Maria Garner?
Well, in the new DSM, it's actually under the addiction disorders now. So there's been a lot of changes in general as to how it's viewed. How it changes interactions or how I interact or how a counselor interacts is it basically adds validity to the fact that it is a real disorder. And it also gives us tools to work with that we already know. For instance, we've worked with all types of drug and other types of addictions. We basically can use a lot of the same modalities. We can use motivational interviewing, we can use CBT, we can use mindfulness. Those are so many different kinds of things that we can use to help with like calming the brain down so that the person can begin to, you know, not react to their triggers or urges to gamble.
And Stacey Fornapple-Hassan, how has the incidence of problem gambling, uncontrollable gambling increased, or what's been the impact of legalized casino gambling and then, of course, the slots and so forth in the at the racing venues?
Well, we did a survey in 2012 before any of Ohio's casinos or racinos opened.
Yep.
In that survey, we found that a little over 5% of Ohioans were already at some level of risk for problem gambling. So 95% of those who gambled weren't getting into any trouble. 5% already were starting to see some risk levels. And about 0.5% were probably already gambling addicted or would be diagnosed with gambling disorder. We redid that survey in 2017, and those numbers had doubled. We had almost 1% of Ohioans who were probably addicted to gambling, and overall 10%, a little over 10%, were at some level of risk for developing gambling disorder.
Now, is there any way to link that directly to the advent of casino gambling?
Two factors would lead us down that path to some extent. One of those is that 24% of people who are at some level of risk for gambling, 24% of them, their main gambling activity was casino or racino gambling. On the other hand, about 24.5% of Ohioans at some level of risk for gambling, their main gambling activity was sports gambling,
which is illegal at this point, right? Supposedly, yeah.
Right. Technically, that is true. you know, it's similar to, in my mind, it's similar to an alcoholic going into a bar. He or she may like to have a beer, but they also might appreciate everything that you see on that back wall, all of those different bottles and all those different colors. And it's a matter of having a lot of choices to make when your brain is going down that path of addiction. And the more opportunities we bring into the state, the more likelihood we will see with people getting into trouble with gambling.
More opportunity, more chance to get in trouble with it. And Maria Garner, is there any, do we know anything about how some opportunities are more addicting or more compulsive than others? So is casino gambling more, you know, if you can go into a casino and do the blackjack table, which I don't think we have in Ohio, but we might. I've never been to a gamble, never been to a casino in Ohio. But are there more as the slots, for instance, more addicting than a card game?
Well, the way I like to look at it is I like to look at it as it's individual. Look at the person individually, because I think that there's a lot of things that go into that. Things such as that person's predisposition, things such as their community that they live in, their income. So there, I don't know if I could say yes, that there is. I think it really depends on people and what has got them gambling. I would say in the African-American community, we see high volumes of slots, poker or any type of card game, craps, any type of dice game. And I think a lot of that is because in the African-American community, those types of gambling have been kind of culturally accepted and have been a part of our culture for a very, very long time. Another thing I would say is with our community, I think it would be lottery as well, because you know, even in African American community, even before the lottery was established, we were playing numbers, and we had number runners. So in places like New York City, you know, African Americans were employed, you know, gambling and employed by gambling joints, which were probably illegal, I believe, but they were employed. And that made up 60% of the African-American community. Mm-hmm. So I guess to go all the way back to whether or not I think there's any specific game that is more addicting than another, I think that there are. I would say there are, but I also think that you have to take into consideration that individual person.
Within whatever cultural community you identify with is right. accepted. And, you know, like, you know, anyone who was raised Catholic and goes to Catholic fundraisers knows there's always a, you know, that Keno wheel or whatever you call it. Then there's bingo.
The roulette.
I mean, the roulette wheel. Then there's bingo, which is another, that's a form of gambling, isn't it, Stacey
yes.
Frenepel-Hessen?
Oh, absolutely. Church festivals.
Yeah.
Bingo. And I personally worked bingo for 23 years. Education. And I use that example a lot. I mean, there are lots and lots of folks who go to bingo and they're supporting the church and the schools, but there are definitely people in those bingo halls who have some problems with their gambling or might even be subject to gambling disorder. You know, I've seen that right in front of me.
Yeah. And when you go into a bingo hall, there's a disproportionately high number of older people. Correct me if I'm wrong on that score. But what I, and also in like if you go into a casino and the slots and that kind of thing, disproportionately higher number of older people. But when I looked at the statistics of who's identified as a problem gambler in Ohio, at least, that's a very low number as older people. Is that a self-identification thing? They're not percolating to the surface. What's that about, Stacey? Do you know?
Well, the surveys were definitely done by individuals. So that was, it was self-identifying.
Okay.
Your habits and your practices. The thing with older adults and gambling is that they don't have as much time to recover. Not perspective, but also a financial perspective. So, you know, if a 25-year-old gets in trouble with gambling, he or she has decades, generally, to come back from that. And it makes recovery, you know, more possible and more plausible. When you're looking at an 80-year-old, obviously, it's going to be a fixed income issue. You know, it's going to be set bills to pay. And that climb back is a lot harder for the older adults.
You know, I kicked off the program by saying that legal gambling in 2020 generated more than $643 million for the state of Ohio. Stacey Frohnapple-Hassan, do we know what it's cost the state of Ohio?
There are some models for that. They're very generalized. I hesitate to talk about, it's a very generalized number. I've seen a number of $260 billion, but I wouldn't put a lot of stock in that because it's, you know, based on a model developed in another state and so on. We know that the costs to individuals, to families and communities can be very high. To businesses, when you have someone, you know, who is misleading the business about how he or she spends their time because they're gambling online when they're supposed to be doing work or when they're supposed to be out on the road for work and they're going to the casino or racino and spending the bulk of their day there, or it's time away from a family and that person maybe is at work, but where they really are is at the casino or racino or a bingo hall or, you know, playing poker on the phone in the car. So there's just endless opportunities, and all of that can be cumulative in how it impacts an individual or a community.
We are going to take a break. Coming up, we're going to hear from an advocate, a person who's in active recovery from problem gambling and who's an advocate and former board member of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio. If you have a question or comment about gambling, my other guests are going to stay with us. That's Maria Garner, a licensed social worker and a problem gambling counselor with Mary Haven's One More Chance program. And also Stacey Frohnapple-Hassan is Chief of Prevention and Problem Gambling Services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. So if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A recent survey found that 10% of white and 19% of African-American adults in Ohio were identified as at-risk or problem gamblers. Gambling can work on the reward system in the brain in much the same way as drugs or alcohol, which can lead to addiction. Efforts are underway in Ohio to curb problem gambling and bet responsibly. Still with us, Stacey Frohnapple-Hassan. She's Chief of Prevention and Problem Gambling Services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Also, Maria Garner. She's a licensed social worker and problem gambling counselor with Mary Haven's One More Chance program. We'll have links to both of those organizations on our website at WOSU.org. Joining us is Jess Stewart. He's an advocate and former board member of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio. He's in active recovery from problem gambling. Welcome to the show, Jess Stewart.
Thank you, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
You were exposed to gambling as a youngster, right? And that kind of got you in the groove. Tell us how.
That's correct. My father was an illegal sports bettor, and he would bet on pro sporting events, baseball, football, basketball. And he would occasionally take me with him to his illegal bookmakers where he would place his bets. That's my earliest memory of gambling history.
And what was that like? I mean, were you aware of what was really going on?
No, absolutely not. I was obviously at that age, I was just a kid. So I found it to be fun. I was very competitive when it came to sports. And my father, if he was still alive today, would tell you that as I became a teenager and that I was better at predicting the outcomes of sporting events than he was. So it didn't cost me anything, but once he would place a bet, and if the teams that I picked won, then I got money from it. And if they lost, well, it didn't cost me anything. So, mm-hmm.
Is that a familiar story, Maria Garner?
Yes, it is. There are many people that are introduced into gambling through families, and a lot of times family members will think that it's a very harmless activity. Like around Christmas time, sometimes people will put lottery tickets in their children's stockings and things like that, thinking that that's very innocent. But in the long run, it can lead to gambling disorder, because when you are exposed earlier, that increases the rate of developing a disorder.
Do you, Jess Stewart, did you consider, do you, looking back, consider your dad a problem gambler? Was he?
In my belief, yes. Undiagnosed, but there is no question in my mind, because he did this on pretty much a daily thing all throughout my childhood and even beyond. When I moved away from home, he was still gambling.
So, go ahead.
No, he even took it a step further in regards to where I would say that he really crossed the line is when he started selling personal things. One thing in particular was a diamond ring that my mother had that she gave to me when she passed away when I was 17, and he sold that ring to get money with which to gamble.
So you were only 17 years old when your mom died, and I'm wondering how that might have played into the trajectory that you were on.
It played a huge role. I did not realize at the time the impact that my mother's death had on me. The last year of her life, I pretty much cared for her almost around the clock, and she became my best friend. So losing her was extremely, extremely hard. I went into a depression, and I tried to cope with that through work and school, but then I also still had a day of the week where I didn't have that, and I turned to going to the racetrack. And I used that as sort of a coping mechanism, because it kind of gave me one night a week where I wasn't focused on her loss, and I was just enamored, because I got an adrenaline high. That was the best that I would feel during the course of a week.
You know, it sounds like the same thing that a lot of people say when they're, you know, maybe they go to the bar once a week, Maria Garner, or I don't know what. I mean, it's an escape.
Right. I have noticed, and I've treated a lot of people that basically a lot of times they'll start to escape an unpleasant emotion or to get away from a traumatic incident. They'll begin gambling because it makes them feel better, and they don't have to necessarily think about their problems. And they can, you know, a lot of the anxiety and worry that they may have during, you know, when they're thinking about these other things goes away when they're gambling. So I could see why that would happen.
And then Jess Stewart, well, first of all, I want to tell everyone you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And let's take a call right now from Mike. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm wondering whether there has been found to be any genetic predisposition towards gambling addiction, and that could be found with twin studies and the likes. And parallel to that, if a person is addicted to gambling, are they more likely to be addicted to alcohol or drugs, or to have a sort of a quasi-addictive behavior, which might be obsessive-compulsive disorder, eating disorder, that kind of thing?
Okay. Maria Garner, can you talk about that?
Yes. There are issues of comorbidity. So when he was talking about, is there an incident that maybe someone that has a gambling disorder may also be more prone to a drug and alcohol problem? Yes, they're saying there's an estimated, there's just quite a few people that have both. So the other thing is he was also talking about with whether or not a person that has a gambling disorder that
is genetically predisposed.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. Yes. And is genetically predisposed? Well, yes, it can be. There are common markers. I wouldn't say it always, it's completely that, but there are markers.
Do you, Stacey Fronapple, do you see that in the data that you collect?
Yes, I just took a quick look at that. And to the question, have a family history of problem gambling? About 7% of non-gamblers said yes. 23% of at-risk gamblers said yes. So three times higher in general terms. Same thing with having used alcohol or drugs while gambling, 100% higher for the at-risk problem gamblers than it is for the non-problem gamblers.
What about you, Jess Stewart? I remember I interviewed the infamous Art Schliester, you know, former OSU football star. Even as he was sitting on the program and I was interviewing him that day, he was scamming people on his next, you know, trip to prison. But, he was very proud of the fact he goes, no, he's a teetotaler, never touched a drop of alcohol, wasn't interested in it. Gambling was his thing. What about you, Jess Stewart?
I was not one to drink or do drugs. I think in my case, the gambling was exacerbated by the fact that I had the undiagnosed mental health conditions,
which depression.
Was a huge contributing factor for me.
So that was depression and?
Yes, and depression, post-traumatic stress, anxiety. I ran the gamut.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Mike, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Anyone else? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org.
I did want to add something. It said individuals who have felt like a painful event or have been through trauma, 35.1% are at risk of problem gambling, but they're also at risk of things like alcoholism and drug addiction as well.
Okay. So Jess, how did you use? You had a relapse at some point, right? You tried to stop, and then you had a relapse.
I had multiple relapses early on. The biggest one came 2008. Was when I first kind of reached out for help. And I was sent to an agency. I'm not going to use their name, but I basically told them everything that had gone on in my life. And I didn't hold anything out. And some of the information that I shared was very intense. It was very deep. And at the end of my intake assessment, the individual kind of turned to me and basically said, well, you kind of have to admit that you brought this upon yourself. And that stigmatizing language should have never been used. I did try to go through the process with individual counseling and things like that. But I felt like they kind of set me up for failure. The counselors at this particular place, they were not gambling certified. So they were sort of treating the symptoms without really looking at the underlying problem. So that was in 2008, but I was able to maintain abstinence for about 4 years through GA and other resources. However, I relapsed again, not only in 2012, but in 2016 for the last time.
What is a relapse for you like?
I was not a gambler who had to go to the casino every day or anything along that line. When the urges hit me, they were very powerful. And I would go on what was known as a gambling binge. So in other words, I would disappear for days at a time and just spend day after day in the casino and rack up losses you know, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000. And finally in 2016, that's when I kind of hit my low.
What was that, if you don't mind sharing?
No, I don't. Basically, it was losing everything. Finally, in accepting that my gambling was uncontrollable, no matter how hard I was trying to fight it, even though I could go stretches of 3 or 4 years, it kept coming back. And every time that it came back, it got progressively worse. And with addiction, that tends to be the case, regardless of what it is. I didn't like what I saw in the mirror anymore. I looked at my reflection one morning and I just broke down into tears. It was just heart-wrenching to think of, you know, that I had reached that point to where I contemplated suicide.
That's not as, you know, you'd like to think that's unusual, but it's not. Is it Maria Garner?
No, it's not. Suicide, a lot of people have contemplated it, and I think it's understandable because what happens is you lose everything. You lose financial security. It's already stigmatized, you know, gambling. So a lot of times you're suffering in silence. You're not sharing your emotions or your thoughts with people about what's going on. And when a person is isolated like that, suicide becomes, to that person, maybe even the only way out. It usually starts with like an ideation, and then later it just develops if it goes unchecked. And a lot of it is a result of depression or depressive symptoms that person wasn't able to get help for due to no fault of their own, you know. So,
Stacey Furnapple-Hassan, when Jess Stewart was describing how somebody was, you know, victim blaming there, is the way I look at it, you kind of shook your head a little bit. It looked like you were sort of frustrated. Now, this was pre-legalized gambling in Ohio. What is that outdated now, or are there still people out there who think blame the victim of the problem?
There definitely still are folks like that. We've been working for years now to make sure that people like Maria Garner, people who are providing that clinical care, are given the appropriate training for gambling disorder. I mentioned that earlier in the program, that 20% or so around gambling disorder that is so dramatically different than the kind of treatment you would give someone for an alcohol use disorder or other drug disorder. Gambling is incredibly unique. What gets people there, you know, might have common markers, something like PTSD, trauma. Those markers may get to it, other kinds of addictions. When it comes to gambling, there are things like wanting the action and needing the action that you don't see in other kinds of addictive practices. That self-medicating piece is very strong when it comes to gambling, and some people do use drugs and alcohol for that as well. But the important thing is that we are providing the appropriate training to Ohio's clinicians, and we actually have, under the Ohio Chemical Dependency Professionals Board, you can get a GAMB added to your license, and that GAMB is telling anybody who comes in for care, this individual knows what they're doing. This individual understands the ins and outs of someone with a gambling disorder. Or professionals that are social workers, marriage and family therapists, and so on, they can get the same body of professional education and declare gambling disorder as part of their scope of practice or their license to practice. And that's where we want to be and need to be in Ohio.
We will continue our conversation. That is Stacey Furnapple-Hassan. She is Chief of Prevention and Problem Gambling Services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Also with us, Maria Garner. She's a licensed social worker and problem gambling counselor at Mary Haven. That's here in Central Ohio. They have a comprehensive behavioral health services operation. They also specialize in addiction recovery. Also with us, Jess Stewart. He is an advocate and former board member of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio. Ohio. He's in active recovery from problem gambling himself. If you have a question or comment, I've got some emails to get to, and we'll also gladly take your calls, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about problem gambling today, avenues for recovery from gambling addiction. Still with us, Stacey Fronapple-Hassan. She's Chief of Prevention and Problem Gambling Services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Maria Garner, a licensed social worker and problem gambling counselor with Mary Haven's One More Chance program. And Jess Stewart, an advocate and former board member of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio, who is in active recovery from problem gambling. Stacey Fronapple, just one more time. I mean, Ohio was a holdout for a long time when it came to legalized gambling outside of the lottery. Does it show up that there was a spike? That there is that I looked at, you know, the 2012 stats for people who called in for help to the helpline, and then compared it with the January one, but I'm just wondering if there was if there's any way of knowing if there was a spike.
We didn't have solid data prior to 2012. We would benchmark Ohio's numbers with those from across the country, and we still tend to be at lower rates than other states. But what we saw happen from 2012 to 2017 told a clear story about additional opportunities leading to higher numbers of people at risk for problem gambling. So everything that we do, you know, as a State Department is based on the data that we have to work with, which is why we're getting ready to redo the survey over the next year. So I'm looking at it about every 5 years at this point.
And Jess Stewart, was that the case for you, the increased opportunity? Did that make a difference in your life? I know you mentioned in your story that you'd go to Las Vegas, you know, the old Sin City scenario. But what about in Ohio here?
Actually, I've pretty much stayed away from Ohio, obviously, in the last 4+ years. My first trip to Las Vegas was in the 90s, 1994. There was no casinos here. And that experience, I don't know how you can even compare it to Ohio. I mean, just the lights and the sounds and everything was totally different. And it just captured my attention. And that kind of led me to keep going back there over and over again.
I mean, it's interesting to me when we think about gambling, we think about the problem that everything about, and we see it replicated in like online apps and game apps and that kind of a thing, the sounds, the music, the colors, all of it goes, it's triggering something, right? Maria Garner, I mean, it's not just, gambling can take many forms. You can start buying too many stars on an online app, right, to play a game.
Well, I've had some really interesting conversations with people. Some have told me that it's the bells. Some have said it's the lights. Some people are mesmerized by the feel, because sometimes when you're in that environment, there's like all these colors. So it almost gives you like this like woozy, woozy, woozy feeling. And so I've heard people say that. And even people that don't go to the casino, they've said things like they have different feelings that they get. So definitely, you know, the atmosphere really plays into triggering.
Yeah. Jess Stewart?
Yeah, if I can add to that, one of the things that I've noticed, especially in the last few years, is they're making the games even more and more interactive to where you have to touch the screen, like in the bonus sections or bonus rounds and things like that. Anything to get you more engaged in the act itself, which really, I believe, is a detriment for those that have issues.
It's like it's drawing you in.
I'm sorry, yes. Maria?
That it's like it's drawing you in.
Right, right. I only went to casinos when I had to go to conferences, and, you know, they'd be in Las Vegas, and I remember one night, you know, going into the casino and playing, I don't know if it was 21 or whatever they called it, blackjack, and I wanted a $5 chip, and the dealer started laughing at me. I was such an idiot, but I made $20 last for about 2 hours. I got up to $80, but that was my limit. You know, I wasn't going to lose more than $20. Jess Stewart, did you ever kind of have that gambit with yourself where you would go in and say, okay, this is all I'm going to lose tonight, but then it never, you couldn't stop?
All the time. All the time. I've heard stories from individuals that basically said, well, I went in and I set myself a limit of $100, and, you know, they lost that $100, and then they went to the ATM machine and took out another $100, and they lost that $100, and they went back to the ATM machine, and by the end of the evening, they had lost $500, and they'd made 5 trips to the ATM machine and paid 5 fees rather than just doing it all at one shot. So that just goes to show you the mindset of gamblers.
Let's see. Charlie and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Charlie.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for calling. It says here that you're in active recovery as well as a gambler.
Yes, I'm a compulsive gambler. I've been sober since August 17th of 15. I'm also a recovering alcoholic with about 14 years.
So for you, there was that comorbidity thing going on.
Yeah, I just wanted to stress the fact that this is a disease, no different than alcoholism, gambling is. It's a disease of the mind, at least for me. And I think the disease model is very, very important to discuss when we discuss compulsive gambling.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what your trigger was? What got you into it in the first place, Charlie?
Well, I have a little interesting story about how insidious this is. I don't know if you guys, well, you know, of course, what EMDR is. And I was doing EMDR. And
I don't know what that is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Psychiatrists use, it's like a light movement type of thing, which can help you recall certain memories.
Okay.
So there was a particular machine that I liked, a slot machine, and it played a certain kind of music. Well, during the EMDR, it was discovered that I liked this particular music because when I was a child, my dad had a truck, and on the back of the truck was a calliope, and the calliope played a certain music. And that music, this machine played the exact same music, and so it triggered a very happy memory in me and made me want to play the machine more. That's how insidious it is.
That's really interesting. There is a certain kind of music in casinos. Maria Garner, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, there is. And I think for some people, that's a huge trigger, just like he said about his childhood. I think it's fascinating that with the brain, things that we maybe have forgotten can still be triggered. And in an environment like that, when you've got all those that stimulation going on, I could see how that could happen so easily.
And so many of the figures and the the colors and everything, it's very childlike, Jess Stewart. It's like crazy cartoony, like kind of a thing.
It is to some degree. To his point, I kind of want to mention the fact that he's right. This disease is insidious. One of the biggest issues that problem gamblers seem to, or things that they hear is, you know, when someone has an alcohol problem, they basically say they need help. If they have a drug problem, they say you need help. If you have a gambling problem, they tell you to just stop. And it doesn't work that way. Gambling addicts can't stop. They can't stop any more than an alcoholic or a drug addict can stop drinking or using their drug of choice. Gambling addiction does indeed cause change in the gambler's brain in ways that requires treatment. in order to arrest it. It's not as simple as saying, like a flipping a light switch and saying, just stop.
What kind of treatment did you get, Jess?
When I reached my low and was contemplating suicide, I had to go, I got away from the state of Ohio. I went to an inpatient treatment center for 30 days. I was at such a point that I did not feel that just like individual counseling once a week or anything like that was going to be sufficient. So I went out of state to Minnesota to a place called Project Turnabout and stayed 30 days inpatient treatment. And that was individual therapy, group therapy, very intense, to where they basically, they identify your triggers, they identify what caused you to start having gambling problems in the first place. It's almost like tearing you down to the foundation and rebuilding you from the ground up.
And who paid for that?
I did.
It sounds expensive, Stacey Fornapple-Hassan. Can everybody do that? I mean, not to mention just taking 30 days to go do that.
Well, what we have in Ohio is free treatment, but unfortunately we don't have residential treatment at this point in time. It's definitely on our wish list, and we know that we need to get some residential care up and running within our state. But Ohioans can get intensive outpatient, which is 6 hours or more of treatment focused on the gambling disorder and anything else that the individual might be.
Six hours a day or 6 hours total?
6 hours a day.
Okay.
So IOP is often used in conjunction with housing. And for someone in Ohio, that's the highest level of care we have right now for people with gambling disorder. There's also outpatient. So if someone feels that they can be helped and clinicians feel that they can help someone with a couple sessions a week, you know, a single session a week, that is certainly another level of care that we have to offer. And all of that is covered by the funding that we get from the casinos in the state of Ohio. Unfortunately, as I said, we don't have.
It's not enough.
Here, and that's why Jess went to the Minnesota program.
I see. Okay. Thank you, Charlie and Powell, for that call. Crystal in Worthington, you're on the air. You have a question?
Yes, hi. It was just I had read about folks who suffer from Parkinson's would take a drug, I guess, to help with the muscle contractions, to calm the muscle contractions down. But then they found a pretty strong link between addictive gambling when these folks were taking this medication. I just was wondering if your caller or your guest had anything to speak on that.
Let's see. Stacey Fornapple-Hassan, anything?
Well, we know it's actually kind of a black box warning now on a number of drugs, and maybe Maria can name what I'm called. I can't.
Okay.
But we're trying to help physicians know to make that suggestion to their patients. When gambling becomes a new habit, it might be because of these new class of drugs that are being prescribed.
Interesting. We're out of time. There's so much more to talk about, but I appreciate all of your time today. Maria Garner, licensed social worker and problem gambling counselor at Mary Haven. That's a Central Ohio comprehensive behavioral health services provider specializing in addiction recovery. Maria Garner, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Stacey Fornapple-Hassan, chief of prevention and problem gambling services for the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Thanks for your time as well, Stacey.
Thank you, Ann. And if I could throw out the Problem Gambling Helpline number, 1-800-589-9966, 1-800-589-9966. And if you want to learn more, go to beforeyoubet.org.
Okay.
Beforeyoubet.org. Thank you.
We will put that on our website as well. It should be there by now at allsides@wosu.org. And we'll keep that on there for anybody who wants to check it out. Jess Stewart, advocate and former board member of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio. He's an active recovery from problem gambling. Jess, thanks for sharing your story. I really appreciate your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for now. Thanks for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.